It would fit. It'd be good. All right, so it's now 9 o'clock or 7 a.m. if you're on Pacific time, according to Alistair's computer. All right, so welcome everybody, and hopefully you had a great time last night at the party. It was one of the cooler parties I've seen in an event, so
yeah.
Hopefully everybody's recovered, awake.
My jeans are covered in dust, actually.
Exactly. We're all covered in dust.
Should have brought my cowboy boots.
So we're here to talk about what we call engineering versus mechanics. Engineers versus mechanics. So that means how the IT world evolves. And we don't have anything against either engineers or mechanics. It just means that from a kind of mechanical sense of the word, setting up metal, setting up data centers, setting up systems, setting up racks, you know, scissor lifts, all these things that we're used to, some of that work starts to go away. And we're going to talk about that over the next 75
minutes. Even on the engineering side, the way that we architect the solutions, the way that we look at how we build these systems, how we operate the systems, and even the sort of engineering disciplines that we use change as well.
Right, so my name is Jeremy Chapman. I'm a director on the Office 365 technical product management team. I'm actually in Redmond normally, doing Office 365 things like planning around especially the clients. So I was brought in from Windows. I used to work in Windows doing the image management, application compatibility. I also worked before that in the Windows Server System Reference Architecture team, infrastructure planning and design as it was called before we killed that out. So those types of things I've been doing basically IT pro marketing, IT pro content, IT pro actually implementation prior to Microsoft when I was in the capacity of an IT pro, joined by Alistair.
Hi, my name is Alistair Spears. I'm a senior operations PM in the Office 365 team. My team focuses on deployment, adoption, and readiness. So we focus on all the deployment tools and guidance to help you get to Office 365. We also build a lot of the user training assets that you can take and deliver down to your end users. We also manage the readiness programs, the training programs, as well as some of the certifications, like the MCSEs and the MCSAs for Office 365 as well.
Right, so kind of getting right to the chase, in terms of what this is about. So a lot of people come to us, whether we're at Ignite conferences, whether we are at events like MEC, we've done a lot of research in the last 6 months, talking to analysts, talking to industry insiders, talking to pundits, talking to IT pros themselves who have actually migrated from on-premises Exchange, SharePoint, Link, all these things into Office 365. What does it mean? Is my last task as an Exchange admin going to be migrating myself out of a job?
Right. Do I have to rely on my former career as an Abercrombie and Fitch model or something like that?
You know, well, if you're related to Matthew McConaughey, it does help in terms of being able to get more jobs in the future. Great things there. So basically the answer is no. So what we found out, even when we talked to analysts who have gone and talked to CXO level folks, they're hearing more and more that, you know, the CXO level managers wanted to say, I want to be able to cut 20% of my workforce.
Yeah.
None of that actually happened. It actually grew and expanded based on the economy itself. We actually have hard data on all of this. So then we decided, okay, we want to dig a bit deeper. We want to talk to the actual people doing the work that have actually migrated to see what happened within their organizations, what their experiences looked like. We kind of did a before and after snapshot with that, and we'll talk about some of those results here. But the main, again, the main point of all of this is that your job does change a bit.
Yeah.
As it always has, I might add, because, you know, Alistair and I, when we started out, when I was doing IT pro work, I was doing, you know, desktop provisioning, automated deployment of Windows to some extent.
Yeah.
There were a lot of guys running around with DVDs or CDs in their hands with multi-activation keys and a case logic case and doing all the deployment. That eventually went to automated deployment, task sequences, all of the stuff that we do around virtualization, scripting, all those things. And we think that with scripting, that would put a bunch of people out of jobs that were running off the case logic cases. But what ended up happening was people got better at what they were doing. We started automating server deployment. We started building out more server compute. And they started expanding into other roles, not just desktop deployment, but other workloads, application servers, et cetera.
That's right. And that's really the funny thing with IT is that we all have way too much work to do. Like, no one has a lot of spare time. So anywhere we can save time, like if we take out that one of those top five tasks, then there's task 6 to 10 that we have to get to that we've never managed to get to in the past. So this is what's been really good about Office 365 for a lot of our customers.
Right, and in general, technology especially, you know, somebody who's studied computer science and really gone into the technology field, technology does evolve. I've got here a little visual in terms of just how music has evolved. We thought it had reached the pinnacle once we had the Zune HD developed. But then, you know, the advent of kind of online hosted music, things like Pandora and you know, hosted kind of curated content, radio stations, cloud-based services in terms of serving your own music collections right there in an online library that you can access from any device. That's really where it evolved to. Similarly, we've seen evolution in terms of the workplace. So it's not just there. If you think about distributed computing, that kind of originated, I think, here, maybe even earlier than this. There used to be non-distributed electricity in factories. The old CEO's title was Chief Electricity Officer. Before they figured out how to get electricity dispersed in the actual machines themselves doing the work, there was a crank that went through an entire factory. Mm. We actually did a stunt with a rally car a few months back with John Case, our VP of marketing. We went through one of these factories. It was a mill that had one of these things running. It had its own power plant. It had its own guy that was doing the work. Of course, all of that evolved into something else later in terms of being able to distribute the actual mechanical constructs of how we're actually processing whatever this part is here, the wood in the case of that, in that wood production plant, down to the actual saw, down to the actual mill that needed it, as opposed to one big shaft that went through the entire factory.
That's right.
If we think about also in terms of IT, you know, back in not so many years ago, a lot of people, anybody start out using punch cards?
There's always someone. Yeah.
So are you still working in IT? So you're still, see, there's proof. So all these things, Fortran, punch card, mainframe, I wouldn't say that Exchange is kind of there yet. It's not obviously not there yet in terms of where it's going, or SharePoint on-prem or any of these things, but it's been evolving. If you think about some of the things that, you know, back in the old days in terms of 1980s, this isn't that long ago. It's 30-ish years ago. But, you know, we thought that we had pretty powerful computing constructs then. And if you think about the compute and the number of servers per person right now, it's only been going up and up and up. And it's kind of the story in terms of cloud. We're not really getting rid of local compute capacity. We might be moving some workloads to the cloud, but rest assured, anything that you have left that's kind of in an idle state on-prem, you're going to reuse that for on-prem resources, right?
That's right, absolutely. Yeah.
So beyond all of that, our history, so we've also gone through some changes in terms of my career before Microsoft and at Microsoft. But at Microsoft, again, starting out at Windows Server System Reference Architecture, architectural blueprints, it was almost like runbooks back in the IBM days that we used to write. It was so great, this product, that we would install directly to the root of C, to the WSSRA folder, which I would have never done when I was in Windows, even 3 years later when we knew how to do application compatibility. That was 900 pages to get what we used to call our mini core up and running. We used to build 34 VMs. It would take us about 6 hours, and we thought it was pretty fancy at the time in terms of all of the stuff. We had an appliance to be able to build out an entire enterprise architecture there. But all of this even became pretty antiquated within a couple of years. Then I was working on Microsoft Solution Framework into Operations Framework. Again, all these things kind of evolved to this extent that, you know, we're kind of standardizing ITIL. We're doing things that are not really requiring that we're sending all of the different guidance around project management, those types of things. Mm-hmm. Even our pocket guide, though, in the MOF days was around 122 pages. Nobody will read a pocket guide of 122 pages. You can still buy these, by the way, on Amazon, I think. They're about $40. And then BDD, one of the crown jewels of Windows deployment, it was to deploy a Windows desktop around 1,500 pages of content plus all the scripting elements that you would compile together that were strewn throughout those 1,500 pages. So it was like a choose-your-own-adventure guide to scripting prior to getting that into a task sequence. So pretty huge changes in terms of when you think about just a few years ago, and BDD 2.0 was back in 2005. Now that's completely archaic and antiquated in terms of that 9 years of span that's happened since then.
That's right. Yeah, in a similar path, I've been around in IT for a while. I started as a developer, and it's just interesting to note that, you know, you tend to bury a lot of products as an IT pro, right? I started working on Java. It was my first thing out of university. Of course, Java is the product it is today, still around in some places, but couldn't find a job in Java. No one was employing. Everyone was looking at Visual Basic at the time, building app dev, those sorts of things. Visual Basic 6, or 5 and 6, and then finally moved into kind of SharePoint, starting doing SharePoint development. This is SharePoint 2003, if anyone ever used, anyone still using SharePoint 2003? No one, horrible product, but great for a developer, because...
It was great at the time.
Great for a consultant, let's say, because there's always work to do. And then I started working into InfoPath, and essentially moving away from that kind of developer space into more of the configuration, you know, workflow side. So things like InfoPath were fantastic as well, because you could build up all of these forms really quickly and focus on the workflow and the business processes rather than the coding that held the form together itself. And then when I joined Microsoft, I started working on a product called Groove, which you can still see around sometimes.
The OneDrive for business executable is still called Groove.exe.
Exactly. So you really find out that it's still Groove when it crashes. But that was another product, right? And it was a pretty interesting product. It was a peer-to-peer collaboration tool. And a lot of that technology is now peer-to-server between SharePoint and Office and those sorts of things in the background as well.
But wait, there's one more.
Yes. And, of course, Microsoft Online Services, or BPOS, the Business Productivity Online Suite. Our first run at a cloud service.
One of our best,
scale.
Any name with POS in it is one of the best naming constructs that we've ever had.
You used to refer to it as the big piece of software.
Yes.
Exactly. Not quite software, yes. But anyway, it always changes, right? And technology keeps changing, and we're at this kind of inflection point again where technology is changing as well.
And there's a huge change in terms of how we build the product, and I think that you're seeing a lot of that, you're feeling a lot of that in the sense that we are putting all the changes, whether it's things like OAuth for devices, whether it's things like some of the SP1 features around DLP fingerprinting, those types of things that we saw in the keynote, those are hitting the service first.
Yeah.
When you think about it, that's a single, joint, unified configuration. It means that we can build technology into that configuration really quickly. We can test it at scale. We talked about all the different rings that we have in terms of how we can get the tap functionality out to tap customers, sometimes up to a year in advance, things like Oslo. We have also first release program where we can get 21 days of additional heads up to people who want to opt into first release. They've got a couple extra weeks to test something as we put it out there. So by the time it hits production, it's gone through a couple different rings of tests, and it's the biggest, in terms of millions of seats deployed in Exchange, the biggest environment that we have. The nice thing is because the changes are being more rapid, we can test them through these types of paths before they actually hit on-premises, but the constant change that we're seeing is really based on user demands.
That's right. And I think one interesting thing to consider with Office 365 and all of these cloud services going forward is that they're constantly changing. And so we need to operationalize all of these change management practices that we used to do kind of on a project-by-project base. And I guess the example of all of these programs like first release, tap programs, where you kind of get the stuff earlier, the way to think about it, though, is that you're not getting it that much earlier. You have the same rate of change as everyone else. You're all on the same train. Some people are sitting in the first carriage. Some people are sitting in the last carriage. But the train eventually gets there. And so that's a really interesting case. You can kind of choose where you sit in the train. If you want to get to the front of the train, yes, you might get to the station first, but everyone else is going to get there at the same time as well.
But the other point on change, the more important point I think here, is that when you think about if I do spend less time building out metal, if I do spend less time working in my data center, building out server racks, building out the core components that are the databases that are the constructions of my Exchange service or my SharePoint service, it basically lets you spend more time doing change management so that users don't go out and find a way to get large file sharing to work or find a way to get business intelligence to work or find a way to sign up for their own Gmail accounts or their own Yahoo Mail or Outlook accounts.com in order to get larger attachments out to people that they need to do it. So you can go and try to block all their ports, but if they're using BYOD, and unless you've epoxied their USB ports on their corporate-provided devices, they end up finding a way. So the way to do that, the way to keep ahead of change and the way to actually free up the time in that sense is if you do have some of these, if you do offload some of the work in terms of the bare metal provisioning, those types of things, change management's probably where you're going to spend the bulk of the additional time or looking across the stack, looking around to the rest of the products.
And it's that notion of balancing productivity with control. It's something that we've been kind of always grappling with. But the reality is now with the cost of technology just dropping and dropping, the consumerization of devices, the ease of provisioning and cloud services, if there's too little productivity, you'll lose control. So you need actually, to get the control you need, you actually need to be funneling your users into tools that they actually need as well. Otherwise, you don't have either.
And when we think about the evolution about how we got here, if you go to the IT pro side of things, so we start out in terms of the last 10 years, it started out with purely physical hardware. We moved to virtualization so we could get better utilization of our hardware, sometimes up to 80% utilization without that extra headroom. Then automation came in after virtualization, so you could actually model your environments, model your application services, be able to deploy lots of capacity if you wanted to. from that extent, we're remoting into anything that we're managing anyway. A lot of times, and I talked to a guy yesterday while I was doing a garage session in the booth, he hasn't been to his data center physically for about 6 years. He's remoted in. He's either used remote desktop services, terminal services if it was pre-Server 2008. He's used PSExec. He's used remote PowerShell controls, all these things that he's doing that don't equate to him actually going and touching the actual hardware, the actual hard drives, the actual devices that are running his Exchange environment. And that's kind of what this is doing. It's basically saying, okay, my data center, I can either put it in my own premises and underneath my own property. I can offload that rack space, or I can just say at the service level, we can offload that workflow itself, but we can still manage it. We can still do all the controls, the configuration of that.
And the beauty of doing everything remotely is it's so much easier to log. It's very hard to log unless you've got like physical logging infrastructure of when someone opens in, goes into a server room or goes into a data center, opens up a rack, opens up a drive, and those sorts of things. There's a lot of logging involved in that. Whereas remote desktop loggings and those sorts of things, it's so much easier just to log all of that and find all of that and then reduce the amount of people that actually have physical access to your servers.
And that's when you talk to the guys who architect the security services around Office 365 or any data center for that matter, limiting the human ability to go in and actually, you know, service the hardware, the hard drives, those types of things lead to better uptime, better availability, because you want to be able to, A, you don't want to give machine-level access to everyone. You don't want them to run executables that aren't whitelisted and available to run on those devices, because the vectors for malware, for bad perf, for anything are generally through unwanted executables that somehow end up on those machines. If we don't have machine access, which by default in this case you don't, you're only communicating to the service at the PowerShell or at the service level as opposed to at the hardware and at the OS level. So you don't have the opportunity to run bad code on those devices.
Exactly.
So from the user perspective, it's also evolved quite a bit over the last several years. So if you think about IT-provided devices, and I've got the nice CRT monitor here with the old Windows mobile device, it kind of evolved into bring your own device where we had a Galaxy, it looks like a Galaxy S4, iPad, those types of things, and BlackBerry's coming in. And everybody remembers the dawn of BlackBerry and all of that.
Yeah.
And then they found a way to get those to work. Those aren't domain-joined devices, and that kind of evolved into how to get services, again, file sharing, Power BI, those types of things, business intelligence, whatever they need that's maybe not provided by IT. Problem is, again, back to Alistair's point, if we don't provide kind of the services that people want, you know, at a fairly rapid clip, and think about things like Link, for example, you know, Alistair and I don't have desk phones. We can use our own laptop. We can communicate with our mobile phones, even while we're riding the bus to work, we can be on presentations, those types of things, and see what's being shared right on our phone screens. If people don't have that technology, they figure out a way to do it. They go out and get, you know, whether it's something like a WebEx or some other client, something to get that working. But the problem is with those types of things, you may not have complete control or complete federation with that service or complete auditability as to what's going on there. So if, you know, if you're getting a lot of work done, say through things like Google Hangouts, and you don't have an actual manageability layer into that, then that basically makes, there's a risk, there's an exposure there, because they're trying to get functionality like desktop sharing or whatever brought into their environments, and they're using other tools. This gives you more control in the sense that you can audit exactly what people are doing, and you can provide rights to services or unprovision users from a service level standpoint.
So quick show of hands, who's looked at where their outgoing mail flow goes on average, which domains? Anyone run those reports on a regular basis? A couple of people? Okay. And who finds it interesting at how much of their outgoing mail goes to a consumer email service? You know, anyone like above 20% of mail to outgoing? 40%? Anyone higher than 40% of outgoing mail? And so that's a very interesting set. What are they doing? What are our users doing with that information? What are they sharing? You know, I had one example where a user was actually just forwarding their entire mailbox, the rule, to their consumer account. They'd prefer to use their consumer account because it worked on all their devices.
Right.
The IT team had locked down ActiveSync and those sorts of things as well, but of course didn't lock down outgoing mail flow.
Yes.
So that's something interesting to consider, that users generally find a way, and you'd be surprised sometimes of running those reports on your own infrastructure.
So the way to bring the two worlds together in the old, you know, with the old domain join construct, there was a way to do that and just have the managed devices talk. The cloud gives you the way to basically manage traffic that goes from your site, your your managed data, whether it's in Exchange or SharePoint, whether it's in a hybrid Exchange environment, however you've got it architected, you can basically control what goes back and forth between them. You can't stop all traffic, but as long as you provide the 80, 90% of what they want to do, it really takes somebody to try to do something rogue, essentially, in order to get other services running. Because at that point, they have the ability, you know, in thoughtful ways, if you've enabled it, to be able to share files externally, maybe to partners, legitimate business reasons. They have the ability to, you know, send bigger email attachments, have bigger mailboxes, the things that they might want that were encumbering them somehow in the past. And you've got the security controls around that to audit every single transaction that's going on, whether it's in SharePoint, Exchange, Link, et cetera.
That's right. I mean, there's always a way. So if we can solve 90% of it with the technology architectures we choose,
right,
the last 10%, we just have to rely on policy. You know, sometimes it's as simple as having an HR policy, a document they sign, it's part of the employment agreement that they have to act this way. And at the end of the day, you know, we have to trust some of our users for a certain amount, because we can never cover everything, whether it's taking smartphone pictures of a document rather than taking emailing the document out, or a USB key or an iPod, or copying content over to some other source.
And I mean, this last week I had a conversation with a company who said, I don't like the Office 365 Pro Plus model because users can install on their home computers. And then I asked, well, do you allow local caching of the OST file on any machine that logs into your Exchange environment? They said yes. So what's preventing that user from buying Office Professional off the shelf of Best Buy and going in and logging in, auto-discovering into his environment, and just sucking down the whole OST into his home computer?
Yeah.
He's like, well, yeah, but you know, people don't do that because they don't want to pay for Office. But that's still, it's not really a security measure in terms of preventing the path into that email. Plus, ActiveSync, all these other things are turned on. Plus, they can go into Outlook, you know, OWA, and all those things to access mail. So it's really not just about like turning off things. It's, it ends up being like a whack-a-mole process. You have to have the right policies in place in terms of some user onus in terms of what they're able to do, because you can't policy manage every device. Not every device is domain joined. Not every, you know, not everything can be locked down from a rule perspective. It goes back to the years and years we've talked about usability versus security and the balance. You know, the more security that you have in place, the less usable it becomes. If you think about things like group policy objects and the things that we do around like government configurations, where it's so locked down that you can't get any work done.
Yeah.
And then you have the enterprise configuration where it's a nice balance. That's kind of what you're trying to strive for. And that balance is always changing depending on what technology is out in the public space. So back to what IT pros who've moved are saying. So people have actually migrated to Exchange Online from Exchange on-premises. Now, we wanted to focus on that specific use case here, since we're at Mac, to talk about what, you know, people were thinking before they migrated and also after they migrated. So the first thing was, you know, this was a federal government agency that was part of, you know, an early adopter group, which was cool in our sense, because we actually love to see, you know, whether it's pub sector, whether it's universities, those types of things, moving early. They thought the data would be more reliable, protected, and so on if it was on premises. That was one of the things that we hear a lot.
Yeah, that initial reaction is that it's kind of, I think of it as a caveman brain. If I can see the server in the morning when I walk to work, then it's surely under my control and more protected.
But reliability, we have a whole under the hood session tonight about this in terms of reliability and high availability. There's a cost to that in terms of being able to have site redundancy. Now, in order to have 2.5 data centers, so I have essentially a way to fail over from one site to the next. Exchange-wise, if I'm in a small environment, I've got to have a DAG with multiple servers in place with multiple copies of the database. There's always a price that comes with availability and high availability and reliability and resiliency of the service. Office 365 being probably the biggest number of seats on Exchange that we have out there, there are multiple data centers to fail over to. That's part of the design, part of the... And if you are somebody who's running 100,000 mailboxes, or if you're in defense and you've got 900,000 mailboxes, you've probably got multiple sites, you've probably got pretty good availability. But this is stuff that's already built kind of right into Office 365.
That's right.
So for this particular agency, they were a bit smaller, so they didn't have the resources to have site resilience and site failover. So in terms of the other one before migrating, in the cloud you lose a lot of control over what happens. I knew it would be very difficult to troubleshoot problems when you move away from your control. So that moves stuff away from your control. That means that, you know, from a troubleshooting standpoint, part of the things that have developed, even in Exchange on-prem in the last release, We've done a lot of work in terms of self-healing, a lot of things in terms of self-detection, auto-detection of things that are failing in the service. So a lot of that does get fixed in Box. Mm. But from a troubleshooting standpoint, we do have a lot of troubleshooting tools that you can do. We have a lot of transparency, and we'll demonstrate some of this with our admin apps, those types of things as to what's going on. And we do seek to provide instant reporting in terms of things going wrong with the service when and if they do happen.
And that's our goal on our part in Office 365 as well. The more transparent we are to you, the less support calls we get. So we really have a very good positive feedback loop to make more and more tools, make it easier and easier to troubleshoot those things. And you see some of that in MAPI over HTTP and the new protocols that we're rolling out and announcing at this conference as well.
And we'll demonstrate that in the messaging center here in a second in terms of that. And this one, at the beginning, I was concerned that my job was being outsourced. So this guy in particular, he set up this server, so he had an affinity to this particular one. He'd spend weekends with it building it out,
Make
sure that light was blinking every time he walked
staring
down the hallway.
Staring into each other's eyes very intently there.
Sorry, I get stock photography from the our Microsoft stuff. But this is a real quote. So what happened was my job being outsourced. Actually, in that case, again, this person was able to continue doing what he's doing, essentially. Change a little bit in terms of the scope of his work, in terms of not setting up bare metal and hardware and updating those types of things, but he was still doing pure Exchange capacity, Exchange admin work after he'd moved to the cloud. So the telling point of all this, that was before migration. After migrating, what did it look like? And this is really where you get benefits, because think about this in terms of just pure raw uptime. These guys have been in Office 365 for a year. They've had an outage for 30 minutes. It was just 30 minutes of email delay in the whole year. What's that in terms of uptime? That's better than 99.9%. Mm. 99.9% is 42 minutes of downtime in a month.
Yeah.
This is in a year. So it's around four or five nines of availability that he was able to achieve. If you're on a smaller, especially if you're on a smaller shop, that's unheard of. Mm. We talk about inbox availability. If you've got one Exchange server with all the self-healing, we'll give you maybe 99.29s in a month. If you got a DAG, you might get to 3.9s. But getting to 4 or 5 9s as kind of the first soiree into the service, that was pretty cool for this particular company. The other thing that we're seeing, this is true kind of across the board. Exchange admins, generally I would say you guys are the smartest of the IT pro set across the entire stack of Office 365 services. Whether that's Link or SharePoint or Exchange or even Yammer, you guys tend to know the most in terms of getting stuff set up, getting the rules in place, the policies, the procedures in place. Yeah. So we're seeing a lot of people actually going in and helping SharePoint teams set up sites, rules, policies against that, because a lot of the stuff that we're seeing, we've even announced the intention and the fact that DLP for SharePoint's coming. Mm. But things like eDiscovery, those things are expanded across the entire service workload.
Archiving, those sorts of things all started in Exchange. And even now that we look at social networking, the social capabilities, and it's kind of fun to laugh at Yammer, but what we really saw in those demos in that keynote was that Yammer is actually coming into Exchange, right? Not the other way around. We're seeing all that stuff included in that Exchange store, so it's in the realm of communication, so it'll be in the realm of the Exchange team to manage.
And I mean, the Exchange influence is why groups are defined in Active Directory, because Exchange uses the purity of what is the Active Directory directory service as opposed to building some other directory and grouping infrastructure somewhere else.
SharePoint.
Those are all Exchange-led decisions that have influenced not only SharePoint, but even Yammer in terms of where we set up groups.
Yeah.
So the other thing that we also have seen is that other areas, mobile device management. So this guy was waiting to do mobile device management, so he's had the ability now to look better at Exchange Active Sync, other technologies, Windows Intune, for example, those types of things to do better MDM in the organization because there are more mobile devices hitting the service. And then finally, PowerShell, something that we're going to demonstrate here, but something that also is critical from a tooling standpoint to remote in, do bulk processes in terms of being able to manage users, manage the service, manage the configuration of service. All the things that you see in the kind of in the admin portal is PowerShell capable. And then one of the other things that we saw in terms of after migrating, jumping from a 250 megabyte mailbox to a 25 gig mailbox and later a 50 gig mailbox, users obviously loved that. Mm. I wouldn't have loved it from a desktop deployment standpoint because the migration files are huge, but we don't want to have PSTs anymore, so that's better.
Yeah.
But from an OST standpoint, that was a large file that our old tools used to migrate. And finally, I think the core quote, the core message here, We didn't have a reduction in staff. Nobody was locked out or anything like that because of Office 365. And this is something we hear over and over and over again. There isn't a reduction in staff. This is something that, to some extent, will disappoint, I would say, the CXO level guys in the company or the people who want this to happen. But it doesn't really happen. Again, the headcount fluctuations are almost one-to-one correlated with how healthy the economy is. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not I've done any cloud-based services or outsourced a few different workloads, because we are still managing the service. We are still configuring the service. We are still responsible for it running from an IT standpoint.
That's right. And the cost reductions we have seen for customers are really around the hardware, storage, SAN investments, hardware support investments, and those sorts of things, less on the personnel side.
And again, that capacity ends up getting reused in every case where we actually do dig in deeper and say, okay, well, now that you've got this rack opened up in these two or three sites, what's happened to, we've reprovisioned other services there. So it's just added more compute. So the other thing is, when somebody asked if Exchange admins were moving their job after the move to the cloud, the response was no's in a room. So this was in a larger room of people. They're not only not seeing any job loss, just changes to the job content and what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So kind of back to the evolutionary point in terms of how we've been evolving technology anyway. You've even evolved in terms of the Exchange administration experience, moving from older versions to newer versions of Exchange. It's just evolving in terms of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And the last quote that I have here is the Aston Martin IT department. They went to one that was kind of custodial, offering support, not really being seen as strategic, to somebody who had more insight into IT, more ability to provide change to users as they wanted it, and that really helped their IT department also get more funding, more money, all of these types of things as part of that migration.
And that's a real photo there. That's the CIO.
That's the CIO. You can watch the video.
Yes,
you can watch the video. You can see Aston Martin's driving around. It's a great one. So in terms of what's new, what's the same, and what's better, in terms of what's the same, we're going to demonstrate some of these things in a second. Configuring the environment, controlling user access, rule configuration, site configuration, all those things are the same. The networking layer on top of it, load balancing, the TORs, those types of things, of course, that type of work isn't the same because we're managing that networking layer as well. Maintaining endpoint system requirements, browser configs, XP or XP end of life, those types of things you have to still plan for and make sure that users are on the right versions of their endpoints. And also from an Android perspective or from iOS or whatever the minimum system requirements are there. So what's new? Reduced planning for infrastructure architecture. And I think that makes it to where I can get services out up and running very quickly. Less integration work to connect the Office services. There are still third-party services that you'll probably connect, but everything is connected right out of the box. That's one of the great things about Office 365. You've got SharePoint, Link, Yammer, all those other things running. Those are connected right out of the box. The new app model is new. There's going to be a lot of net new developments. If you're a developer out there, it's looking at maybe some stale code that's been running for years and years and years on your client side or on your server side, the app model is going to give another lease on life because it also gives you more extensibility options across device types, platforms. And identity management is going to be new for a lot of people in terms of you've got a directory service there, you've got AD running probably, but in terms of hooking into that and having Azure Active Directory as part of a synchronized directory service, that's going to be all new. And we're going to show some of that in demonstrations in a second. What's better? Again, the integration between services out of the box, no more updating and upgrading of servers, fewer lost weekends and late night calls. We've seen that over and over and over again as we talk to the people who have migrated, especially the weekend change windows, those types of things start to go away. Less time spent keeping the server up and more time to implement new capabilities. And this is really the crux of where you're going to spend most of the time now from an online services standpoint. It's change management. It's the new features that are rolling out, sometimes on a quarterly basis, and keeping ahead of that. But for that, IT will get the credit in terms of being able to show all of the net new functionality. So let's actually jump into some tools now, because we've talked so long, I want to actually do some demos. So we're gonna go straight to our demos.
Sure.
And we'll go
so
back
let me
to
jump across. Kind of take you through the admin portal. So the admin portal is this one place of truth that once you're on Office 365, you kind of live and breathe here, whether you're on the mechanic side or whether you're the architect or the engineer on call. This is really the tool that you'll be working with on a day-to-day basis. Now, everything you see in this interface is actually a PowerShell script behind the scenes. So Jeremy will take us through some of those PowerShell actions that you can do to automate a lot of this stuff. I'll take you through the nice, easy-to-use GUI experience as well. So the first thing that we prioritize when you log into this environment is the service health. You know, and this is kind of the first thing we want you to see every day, and we'll show you some other ways that you can get this content every day. But really, we want to focus on that straight up front, so you can see all green across the board here. You can see, oh, something happened with Link last night, 5 a.m. I can click into this and go into the service health dashboard here and get some more information about the issue that happened. So the issue here looks like we had some Skype and Link interoperability issues at 3 a.m., solved by 5 a.m., and those sorts of things as well. Now, you could run this yourself, you could do all this yourself, but it would be you filling out all of these reports at 3 a.m. in the morning, not the Microsoft engineers.
And waiting sometimes for the help desk to ring to get reported that, hey, my Link and Skype connectivity is not quite working right, and then you'd have to go and investigate that.
You know, and that's the challenge with, you know, with anything supporting like this, and one of the reasons why we were on that three-year release cycle for so long was that we just had to do a whole lot of testing. Because, you know, if we release something out to you and you deploy it and there's an issue with it that's actually in the product itself or in the code or in the configuration, the documentation, the fastest we can get hot fixes out of that model is about 4 weeks. And so if you're down for 4 weeks, that's a really nasty experience. Now when we're on this 3.9s, there's 99.9% availability. You know, you can't be down for any longer than 43 minutes. And so our four-week dev test prod and hot fix release channel was just way too slow to get out these changes as well. And so that's why you see Office 365 moving a lot faster now, because we don't have to wait to test every single weird and wonderful topology that you guys might have invented. We just focus on the one topology, Office 365, and those sorts of things.
And you also see that in terms of the configuration options in 2013, the consolidation of server roles. We want to get to a simpler environment because, again, troubleshooting Exchange and traffic, when you've got a very complex network infrastructure with, say, lots of load balancing, lots of TORs, lots of other equipment, it's hard to repro that from a support call standpoint. So we've gotten to the point where, again, we want a lot of that self-healing to be in the box because we want to have a somewhat uniform configuration out there in terms of how Exchange 2013 servers are actually up and running.
That's right.
In the sense that it will be more up, so simple is better, and we'll talk about that again tonight when we've got Abram Jackson downstairs in the garage tonight under the hood session. But this is all about, you know, being able to keep a unified configuration. We can test things at scale with millions of mailboxes, lots, you know, thousands of tenants, you know, on an ongoing way to where we can validate those builds, validate those fixes, and all that stuff very quickly.
Absolutely. And so you see also here all the different components that we measure here. So you do have this dashboard available to you at any time. You can see the status of not only the service all up, maybe today in your own SCOM reporting, you can tell whether Exchange is up or SharePoint's up or SQL's up or something like that. We want to give you even more information than you can get on premises in the one pane of glass. So you can see here not just the service itself, but we're measuring things like timely delivery of email, whether the sign-in service is working, the provisioning service is working, you know, the federation capabilities, and all those sorts of things here. And so you can see all that in a very easy view here. There's an RSS feed, there's an API for you to implement in with your help desk content, and there's also mobile apps that we'll show you in a second as well. So the other thing that, you know, we're really managing here, and because this is now outside of our organization, once upon a time we knew exactly who our users were. There were people that came into work every day, and everyone worked in a building, at an office, or a desk. Now our users are everywhere. We have contractors, vendors, traveling salespeople, partners, even competitors. And we do a lot of collaboration with competitors on these systems because that's the only way you get standards developed and those sorts of things as well. And so for IT, we need this much more porous sort of environment where we can let in whoever we want and we can kick out whoever we want in that system as well. So identity management becomes really important here. And you can see how we manage all these identities. Let me pick Alex here. I can go in there, and I can actually just assign them these capabilities as well. So if I don't want them to have an email inbox, I don't have to assign them Exchange. If I want to give them, in this case, Power BI, all I need to do is activate the Power BI on them, and all of a sudden we've given them all this extra capability. All the servers, all the infrastructure, all the workloads are already built. They're just waiting for you to flick the switch and turn them on. So it's not like there's any build time for us to deploy another service.
And I think one of the more powerful examples of that, if you go into OneDrive for Business Management,
Yeah.
You go into your SharePoint portal, I can give everybody, if I want to, up to a terabyte of storage per user. And I don't have to worry about storage. I don't have to worry about setting up the servers in order to do that. It's literally, you know, add the names, either,
yeah,
you know,
so
multi-add, it will do an auto discovery, drop-down box, or I can PowerShell script everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then, boom, I can give everybody half a terabyte or a terabyte of storage capacity in their OneDrive sites just like that without worrying about, you know, having the capacity in the data center to actually do that.
In this case,
Alistair has 42 gigs of capacity and 21 gigs already used, so he can't do that himself.
Yes.
But when you've got, basically, you just purchase the service, provision it, boom.
Exactly. You can add all these
there's
things.
There's infinite storage.
Very easily here as well.
So beyond all that, if we think about the Exchange admin portal.
Yeah, so let's have a look into there.
It is verbatim identical. I mean, the only thing you don't see there is a CAS server node in terms of the bottom left-hand side, but all the areas there are identical to what you'd experience on-prem.
And what we're starting to see now is more of these capabilities light up first in the experience as well. So you can see here the Exchange Online Protection capabilities built into the administration console. You can see our e-discovery data loss prevention capabilities all built into this service as well. And what this allows us to do is then get consolidated reporting across all of these environments as well. So for the first time, you don't have to worry about handcrafting your reports off your Exchange logs or anything like that. We do all that logging for you. You know, across our service, I won't give you the exact numbers, but it's hundreds of millions of mailboxes running in Exchange Online. And all of that generates terabytes and terabytes of logging, about 25 terabytes of logs every day. And Perry had this graph about, you know, the usage of Exchange Online and those sorts of things. And what actually happens in that downtime, we kind of repurpose that spare capacity to actually just process all those log files into a human-readable format. And what you see here is the output of that every 24 hours. You see that dump of extra reporting that shows you everything from, hey, where did your received mail come from, which DLP rules were accessed, how much storage is being used by different people. Has anyone that's not an owner of that mailbox accessed that mailbox? It's a really interesting report, this one. So you can actually keep tabs on the rest of your IT department to make sure that they're not doing things they shouldn't be. Another common example when we're thinking about compliance and security is, has someone changed access permissions on a role group? You know, it's something that if you're very security conscious, you're very worried about people that have permissions to escalate administration rights and then de-escalate administration rights, and then that's very hard to find. And so that's, again, some of those actions that we capture and we take. So you can run this report, and then you can see people that have actually changed any of those administration capabilities in the service, given themselves access to a mailbox, then removed access to the mailbox after they've done their nefarious task or anything like that. And you can see all of this reporting straight in the portal as well. It's the same reporting pipeline that we use at Microsoft to manage the service, and you can actually see Microsoft users if you raise support calls or something like that, and you've had an engineer that's actually had to look at a particular mailbox. You can actually see in that audit report that same result correlated to a service request ID or something like that as well. But one of the great things about all of these management capabilities and all these reporting capabilities, it does free up time to do different things. And so what we've seen a number of organizations do is start to finally invest in the next thing on their checklist. And many organizations, that's actually business intelligence, the ability to have business intelligence capabilities. It's been like the Gartner's CIO top 10 thing for the last 15 years,
it's,
I think.
Yeah, it's always been number one buzzword in terms of where to invest IT funds, spare IT funds.
Yeah, it's the one everyone says they're doing and no one's actually doing.
There's a great Mark Rusinovich slide on that one. I won't reference it. Anyway.
So Power BI is the capability in Office 365. What you saw me do before when I opened up that user and I clicked, hey, now we'll add some business intelligence capabilities. They're deployed, they're online. In my case, it was actually a trial account. So you can have a production usage. Then you can just attach a trial of some other service or some other capability, try it out. If you like it, you can move to production then. It's a free way to move without having to worry about servers or any of those other capabilities as well. And what Power BI really allows you to do, let me jump back here. Power BI, and this is Power BI, it's actually, you can think of it as a search engine across all of your business intelligence data as well. So if you have SQL databases, if you have line of business applications, CRM applications, or even spreadsheets, if your users have a lot of spreadsheets and spreadsheets are the authoritative source, this tool actually allows you to do natural language searching across those spreadsheets as well. And so what you can see here, I've got a bunch of saved queries. And so the case I can do here is I can actually make a query, save it, add a little image to it and those sorts of things, and then publish it out for other users to use the same queries. So think of this like a search engine. And then if I want to look at particular things, population of the European Union here, there you go. And all I need to do here, and it's essentially just saving that search query there as well. If I wanted to choose something else, population of Australia.
A little smaller
than
the
EU. A little smaller than the EU, yeah. Or I want to look at swimming. I have my Olympics data set here as well. One click. And you can see that. You can see I'm typing something. But you see that blue text underneath that? It's actually doing the natural language processing of the query you typed. Here's what I think you're asking for. Show swimming medals where host country is Australia. It's not exactly actually what I was asking for. What I was asking for is show medals count won by Australia.
There we go.
Yeah, it's a little bit better. Yeah.
All right.
So easy to do these sorts of queries, save these sorts of queries. And all this is done on the fly. So we don't actually have that particular query written out in the Excel spreadsheet. It's actually Office 365 interrogating that spreadsheet and giving you the right answer as well. Another one, let me try and find a good one here. This is a slightly different approach. In this particular one, we're actually looking at that data and we're asking it to graph. And maybe you want to ask instead of a line chart, let's say we want a scatter chart. We can type that very easily. And then we'll just replay that information. And we can even do it with the timeline as well, so you can see the changes to CO2 emissions over time for the last 20 years.
U.S. is close to the world level in terms of its CO2, it looks like.
Exactly.
All right, so, but the main point, I think, of all this is that you can have, you know, extra peripheral services that you add on to the workloads
yep.
that you have within Office 365.
That's right.
It's very easy to append net new services and
exactly.
capabilities
and
there.
This is important work that we've always wanted to get to that we've just never been able to
right.
do before. Yeah.
So, and beyond all that, we also have the ability to monitor the service right from our mobile devices. So I've got here a Windows phone. I could be running an iPhone or an Android phone, but my Windows phone, I've got Office 365 admin portal running, and I can see exactly that my services are online. We saw the link issue mm-hmm. earlier that I could drill into and get exact issue on, you know, the Federation, the outage with Skype. It's the same exact message that we had there. Mm-hmm. I can go down into Exchange Online if I want and also look at all the services. And, you know, most of the time, because we're going for 99.9% uptime at least,
yeah.
then these are going to be green. They're going to be healthy because there are only a couple minutes of downtime in a month. Yes, you have a question?
Is that something I can give my CIO but not let him touch things?
Yes, the nice thing with this app, so the question was, if you're listening at home, is that something I can give to my CIO without letting him touch things? Yes. Because this doesn't actually do any fix or repair commands to a state of the service. So he can see what's running if there's any downtime. He can log in. You just probably give him a dummy admin account. And then he can basically have the ability to see everything there. You don't have to even have to provision him services, because then if you know basically a free admin account will not attribute to your service workload usage. And then he can use this app himself and be able to see exactly what's going on. And, of course, I can manage that. So let's say I don't manage all these services because I'm scoped on Exchange or a couple of related services. I can also get that list down if I don't want to see the noise, I guess, of Office subscription or something else. Nice thing is it refreshes itself every 15 minutes. So even if the phone's network connectivity goes offline, I'll be able to see the last report. Or every 30 minutes if you want to set it to do that. And if I want to get rid of things that maybe don't matter to me as an Exchange admin, I can get rid of Office subscription and Yammer Enterprise, for example, hit save, and it will only show the things that I care about. Maybe Link, Exchange, Identity, Office 365 Portal, RMS, and SharePoint Online. So very cool stuff. And if you happen to have an iPad or an iOS device or an Android device, we also have the same types of clients for those. So even if your CIO, for example, has a non-Windows phone, which he probably does, then... Sorry, that wasn't meant to be a joke.
Not our CIO.
He's not. Our CIO does.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Our CIO is better. No, I'm just joking. But on the iOS device,
yeah. So
we have
all these apps
experience.
As well, and we have the Office 365 admin app. And you can see that same experience here. You can see the maintenance windows, and you can control all that from whatever device you're on. So this is on Windows Phone, iPhone, iPad, Android phones, all have this app available. And of course, there's the web app, an API if you want to roll your own as well to do those sorts of things as well.
Right. And even and kind of beyond all of that, if we go back into, I'm going to go into PowerShell now and show some things. So again, one of the main things that we're going to hit in terms of net new requirements and net new kind of services that we may not be as Exchange admins used to seeing, directory services. So in my tenant, I have a couple of people. I have Alistair, myself, mod admin, and test. Mm-hmm. Test is a very prolific user in my admin portal. He's the CIO account, actually, who's looking at reports in terms of what's going on. If I wanted to add a user, I can go in and manually add him by clicking the plus sign and doing that and basically going through a manual set. Hmm. That's great for like 5 users, maybe 6 a day or something.
And if you're starting out, you add your test users, test like this.
The test guy, that's what I added yesterday. But what I'll do actually here is I want to actually add quite a few more users. So I have a CSV file, and maybe I'm not committed yet in terms of doing a directory sync. Mm-hmm. But I want to add, for a pilot group or something, 150 or 200 users, or 250 users that we can do with our fast track service if we want to do that, if we get a tenant running. So let's say I've got 250 IT admins. I'm a big shop. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to try Office 365 and try Exchange Online, those types of things. I can do that with a CSV file. I can output the CSV from my directory service, whatever I'm using. And then I can use PowerShell to do bulk activities. So I'm already logged into PowerShell, and if I want to, I can basically add users. And I've got the add user command that will show up once I put it here in the PowerShell window.
So you've made your PowerShell look like Notepad there.
So I basically took my PowerShell and I aligned it to the new UI paradigm of Office 2013, making it white with black letters. Not all caps though.
No,
I couldn't do that somehow. But basically now I'm able to do bulk commands of the users. So if I go back into my portal, I'll see that after I refresh my page, I'm getting users very quickly added into the service. So if I want to do bulk jobs, not just configuration, but anything that's going to require me to click too many times on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, I'm going to want to automate that. So the nice thing is with something like this, even if I wasn't using dir sync, normally we'd say if you're on a bigger environment, you should use directory sync, because as people get hired in, directory service is a source of truth. Every 3 hours, that will get synced, and then put that user object directly into your Azure Active Directory store. If for the pilot, though, if I want to do some bulk tasks and just say, I want to filter down what commands I want to do to various users, I can use that CSV file as kind of the filtering point. Yeah. I can use attributes also, and the AD is filtering points as well. But in these demos, I'm using that list file as kind of the attribute filter as to who gets what service. For example, I can turn on services, those types of things. So now when I refresh again, let's see how my PowerShell script is going. Because I'm adding 200 user accounts here in the span of a few minutes. I'll know because I'll get to some very Turkish-sounding names once it gets to the bottom.
Yeah.
We have a name generator at Microsoft that lets you do legally compliant persona names, and I was able to generate 180 of them. So if the names were protected to or changed to protect the innocent here in terms of who all these guys are. But we'll see when I go in to any one of these users, I don't have any services provisioned. So one of the first things is people will ask, well, now that I've got the user ID populated, why is there not, an enterprise pack or an Exchange Online or some type of service already running? The second step, or you can combine it with that step actually, is to provision the service capability of that user. And I can do things like this checkbox here is represented in PowerShell by a license type of enterprise pack. And I can also remove some of the subservices if I wanted to, say, get rid of Office 365 Pro Plus or SharePoint or whatever I don't want users using as part of my pilot. Those are all things I can do as additional configurations within PowerShell to not provision those services if I want to do that. So now that we are a bit further along, let's see if my PowerShell is finished. Yes. Now I've got to do a couple other things in terms of getting them services up and running. So first thing I'll do is I'll see what SKUs I own. And then I can do that very easily with that really simple PowerShell command.
And so this is essentially a license check that any admin can do rather than being the person that's signing the checks and those sorts of things and knowing the obscure.
Right. And I can go into one of those users manually and provision, you know, how many active units I have of that account SKU. And that will show me kind of what I have left. In my case, I have 246 left, but here we see we've got 250. We're going to set usage location, because this is about in terms of what country they're in. So we'll do that. Again, PowerShell to set the usage location to the US. And that should be a fairly quick command to run around all of the different users. So that basically says, OK, all these users, we've just imported them. We're going to set the usage location. So these are some of the things we can do, but there are, of course, within PowerShell, many, many, many things that we can do. And if I go back into my portal, I can go and cancel out of that, and I'll look for Chris Green, because he's really high on my list. He's a real guy, actually, that works in Redmond, Chris Green, as is Katie Jordan, all the other demo personas that we tend to use. But we'll see here in terms of details, he should have US defined somewhere. Hold on. United States, country, region defined, all that is ready to go. Let me go back to my PowerShell here, because that should be nearly baked. There we go. Now I'm ready to run more stuff. So now I'm going to give them the actual E3 licenses, what we call Enterprise Pack again, right in with PowerShell. So we'll add that capability. Now we can go back to our friend Chris if we want to and have a look at Chris Green and what his license allocation looks like. So now we saw that with that script, again, I've automated everything that was in the UI in terms of being able to provide all those different services. But it goes beyond just Chris Green. I'm going to be adding that to all 190 or so users that I've got into my pool, 180 users that I've got in that CSV file. So all these things that I'm doing is kind of normal, repeatable tasks. I'm going to want to script all of that, as you would in kind of any IT situation where you don't want to do a lot of clicking. You don't want to, you know, if you install software, you don't want to hit the next button 80 times before you're done installing Exchange 2013.
Yeah.
Why not automate that? So that's part of what we're doing here with the scripting.
And this self-service has been the holy grail of IT for so long, but we've always been crippled by the capacity side. I remember even back in the SharePoint 2003 days when I was doing a lot of development around that, we would always try to do this self-service site creation and those sorts of things, but we're always crippled by the amount of storage we had and those sorts of things as well. What you see here is these tools automatically scriptable. You have the scale of Office 365 behind the scenes. So finally, we can actually have that a self-service portal that's just kicking off these scripts, you know, escalating the privileges. So it could be your help desk or someone like that that can run these tasks. Or even it's your HR system or your SAP system that as soon as you add a record, you're going to do certain things, create sites, move users, assign users, resegment users for different capabilities, and those sorts of things as well.
So now I'm going to connect to the EXO service. So I'm typing here accurately. Because I can also do Exchange tasks as part of that. So let me make sure that I've got access into that session.
So now rather than Office 365 all up, you're looking just at the Exchange.
Now I can, so if I did a query for git command, for example, within, as I was using the Azure, let me get the exact name, the Azure Active Directory module for Windows PowerShell. Mm-hmm. We do make names still for products that don't fit on the side of a bus. This is one that we wouldn't usually advertise on the side of a bus anyway, which kind of works out.
Maybe at Mac.
Maybe at Mac, exactly. So now we're in there, so let's import our PowerShell session. And get that running. All right, so I should be able to now, after I'm done. Here we go. Now I'm importing commandlets, assuming my Exchange gods are happy. The names of the imported commands from the module TMP include unapproved verbs, okay? But let's not use that. Let's not use that script. So what we're going to do here is set IRM policies, for example. This is just one thing that you can do. This is part of, for example, Office 365 message encryption. It uses IRM at the core. So even to enable that feature, we've blogged about it, we've talked about it. It's not a checkbox you can go in and just click in order to do OME configuration and to set up a banner on your site and to put a disclaimer on the bottom of your encryption mails that automatically get generated. That stuff, you're using PowerShell to actually implement a feature in Office 365 that is more or less a marquee feature.
Yeah.
A lot of times, the PowerShell will be ahead of the actual GUI that represents what that PowerShell does. And I think that's important here.
We can't build the GUI until we have the PowerShell, so you always find it.
And it's always, from an engineering perspective, you know, in every product group I've worked in, Windows, in the server and tools business, also in Office, it's always easier to build the PowerShell or the command line to do something as opposed to building out the GUI for it, because the GUI requires localization and all those different things. So if you wanted to have... So here I already had that IRM setting set, but you can see that I could configure this configuration successfully, but it saw that it was already set. So it gives you a nice warning there as well, saying what's going on. So even beyond that, I can do other things. I can do, if I wanted to import the RMS trusted publishing domains, if I wanted to set IRM configuration, if I want to do things like remove PowerShell rights for non-IT users, I'll get the same warning because I've already done this. But basically, if I wanted to do that, that way other people can't remote into the environment and start using PowerShell if I don't want them to. So it's relegated to just admins. If I want to do that, it's a subset of admins. So normally a global admin can do everything, and we have different rings of admin capabilities. I might want to just have half of my admins, maybe the SharePoint guys, not be able to, sorry, it wasn't a SharePoint joke, not be able to use PowerShell to configure my Exchange environment. This will let me do that. So they might have a tenant admin level access by default. They'd have some kind of configuration capabilities using PowerShell. This way, if I want to, I can remove that capability from that subset of admins.
That's right. So you still have all that control, all that granular control in Office 365 to do all those.
And this is just tip of the iceberg. So one thing I like to think about with any scripting is, you know, you're gonna configure this a lot of times. One time you're gonna set up a script sheet, whether it's a PS1 script in terms of a PowerShell script itself or a text file, however you want to build it. That's going to have all of that stuff. You're going to maybe with some bulk tasks, you might have lists that you're doing, or you know, output from your Active Directory. You might want to use OU filtering, however you're going to filter out who's going to do what. But basically, you can use those in terms of automating bulk creation, bulk assignment, bulk configuration tasks that really apply to every user. So if I want, you know, half of my user base to have the ability to use S/MIME, for example, something we just announced through OWA, I can do that. I can just have that relegated to part of my organization, not the entire forest or the entire tenant in every single mailbox within it. So pretty cool stuff in terms of being able to remote into a remote server running Exchange in a software as a service, kind of a multi-tenant fashion, and being able to configure exactly how everything works within my environment using complete scripting automation with PowerShell. So all of that has been capable for a long time. The PowerShell commands get added pretty much daily in terms of what you can do to configure the environment.
Absolutely.
So moving back to our presentation. So beyond all of that, let me see if I can go back to our slide that I skipped past. So one of the current trends, so beyond all the demonstrations that we saw, what we're seeing from an IT standpoint is a lot of the knowledge, a lot of what was centralized in central IT is getting dispersed throughout the organization. Part of that is because the barrier to get into a cloud-hosted service like BI, sometimes people will buy, especially from a marketing standpoint, they'll buy into, say, social media, those types of things that will be led by the marketing team, but the marketing team has no idea what IT needs to do in that construct. So a lot of times IT comes and reels it back in a few years later.
Even at Microsoft last week, I met a guy in consumer marketing team whose job was to manage 50 servers for business intelligence reporting. So you know, what we traditionally thought of the IT professional in the IT department is now spread out so far and wide as technology's got easier and easier.
And you're seeing that, I guess, as people come out of university, they're not necessarily going to a direct kind of central IT role. They might be that guy that's the, you know, the Excel guru that knows how to do Power BI going into the finance department. He's doing essentially an IT function, and he's got to be able to set up hooks into SQL services, whether they're on-prem or in Azure.
That's right.
All those types of things are just expectations in terms of IT, again, getting dispersed throughout the org. And that's something that we're seeing, again, everywhere.
Yeah.
We're basically, and kind of back to the user finding the way, business units end up finding a way in terms of doing things sometimes out of the purview, out of the scope, out of the view of IT, without the auditing capabilities, without the kind of data management custodian capabilities that you guys have as kind of chief security officer or chief data officer within your orgs. This, again, as Office 365 expands the scope of what it can do, we're going to be looking for trends in the market, building out those capabilities, and this will help, again, get you to a position of more control because you have the audit path of where any of that data is flowing, where any of those files are going.
That's right. I mean, 5 years ago when the economy wasn't so good, we kind of derogatorily referred to this sort of stuff as shadow IT and those sorts of things. But
right.
The reality is now it is a reality. So there's no, it's not shadow IT. It's not good or bad. It's just what we're dealing with. And so we have to adapt. We have to work with this now. And we have to have systems that central IT can still manage at least a sandbox environment
right.
that these other IT dispersed people can actually still access and do their job.
And back to beyond just, you know, IT maybe moving from central role out to the business units to some extent, we've also seen from a change management standpoint, there have been huge amounts of changes in terms of the Office 365 service since inception. Again, if you've got a dollar to spend or 40 hours in a week and you did free up 5 hours by not managing software updates or not building out metal or doing data center management or remoting into your on-prem environment, there's enough to keep you busy in terms of change management. One of the biggest things that we hear is a user will complain about something. Mm. Oh my gosh, I can't do character recognition with inking in OneNote like I can do in Evernote or something. Well, that's been there since 2007. What are you talking about? A lot of times I just aren't aware of that capability actually being in place. Or I wanted to be able to attach this large file, and how come the email attachment limit is, you know, 25 gigs or whatever? Mm-hmm. I want to do 100 meg file. Oh, well, we've had SharePoint in place for the last 8 years that lets you do that. A lot of times the users don't have the knowledge in terms of what they can actually do, and the capability's been sitting there the whole time. Like we would, you know, when you were out in the field, you could show people doing, you could show stuff that was maybe from last release, if they're on a 2 or 3 release version, old version of Office,
exactly.
and say, look at what you can do with this new one. Oh yeah, it's been there for the 3 versions that you've skipped, but it's still awesome stuff.
And it's kind of an interesting challenge for IT. I mean, you can go, for those that are using Exchange 2010, just because Exchange 2013 released, doesn't mean your Exchange 2010 skills are out of date or anything like that. You could be still running Exchange 2010 for the next 10 years and use those skills.
Right.
In Office 365, like if you had skills in BPOS, that product doesn't exist anymore. Like, it literally is disassembled. Around the Microsoft Office, people have pieces of the hardware framed, you know, in their offices once we disassemble the hardware.
Like pieces of the Berlin Wall or something.
Yeah, so it's not like that the skills are no longer relevant entirely because the product doesn't exist. So if you're not on this evolution train, you don't actually stay up to date.
Right.
And that's an important.
And the biggest thing, another thing that we saw also with from a help desk perspective, and we've got data, it's about a 1% help desk call duration length if somebody knows Exchange and knows how it works, versus having somebody on the other end of the phone who's never ever done any email administration, doesn't know networking, doesn't know all the aspects of getting a mail item from one mailbox
to
another mailbox. So that really helps in terms of just troubleshooting and you know, if you do have to call support, which most people don't, but in the case that you do, it really gives a big foot up beyond just the configuration, the change management, the capabilities that you are implementing.
Absolutely.
So beyond all that, in 2013, we've done a lot in terms of adding net new functionality. Even at SP1, we've done a bunch of stuff. Some stuff that's actually relegated to just the online services, a lot of stuff that is coming out into Service Pack 1 directly, but you can see again, a lot of this goes down to being able to train end users. Hey, Exchange Online now is a 50 gigabyte mailbox. What does that mean? Users are going to love that. Typically, they're going to like bigger mailboxes. You know, there's no downside. This is part of this the package that we manage on our side in terms of having that larger mailbox up. There's no storage impact, I guess, on your end in that sense. So these types of things have to be communicated out, and you'd have to let people know that these changes are happening. And that's something that a lot of users, they'll get new functionality, new features, and they won't know that it's all there. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, and freeing up a few hours a week will give you the capability of letting them use the new features as they roll out.
Absolutely.
So this is just some of the big things that we've done in the last year there, Geoflow that we've gone into PowerMap as part of SP1. So we've shown admin portals, so some of the tips in terms of where it makes sense to invest more time to learn. We've got a lot of sessions this week on this. Mm-hmm. Admin portal, PowerShell, Office 365 admin app, all these things will help. We've also got more data if you want to read, if you want to actually see what the impacts of cloud are in terms of information technology departments, IT departments. Cisco's done a survey, IDC's done a survey, we've done our internal survey. All of the survey data equates to the fact that cloud computing isn't causing job loss, in a lot of cases causing job creation. A lot of that's because of the uptick in cloud being basically correlated with the uptick in the economy since 2009 as it's been coming out of recession. there isn't basically a direct correlation in terms of outsourcing any workloads to cloud to IT, you know, role loss or IT spend loss within orgs.
That's right.
And that's kind of the main point here. And that's what you'll see as you look through any of the research. And we have looked through all of that, and we've done our own research, and we've talked to the analysts who have built the research. So all of it's pretty much unanimous in terms of the impact of what Office 365 means. Big thing, though, and the kind of the closing thought in terms of all of this, all the change management, bigger mailboxes, whatever it is that delights users, whatever they want, whether it's being able to use the iPad or being able to use their Windows phone or their iPhone or their Android phone with OFOR devices, the things that we saw in the keynote, this is something that you guys, as IT pros and IT, you know, IT admins, get credit for. The users don't know who's running the service. They don't care. They just know I work at Contoso or Northwind or whatever the different companies that we use. And I've got all these great new services, and they've just rolled out this new thing that lets me do things like I would have had to use third-party service, pick one, you know, Google Hangouts, Dropbox, whatever they're using now. In some cases, I can do all of that by the services that IT gives me. So IT is basically moving the dial. A lot of end users think, and a lot of business departments will think, that IT is impeding their ability to use net new technology. Hopefully, this will help in terms of that reputation a lot of companies, a lot of departments, a lot of IT orgs have in terms of impeding based on security requirements and things that you need to enforce. Yeah. You need the audit trails. You need the things that we would provide reporting-wise. But they'll go out and they'll find find a solution using maybe consumer technologies or boutique solutions or things that aren't as robust. Using those, you don't have any insight into that data. If it becomes business critical, then that provider goes out of business. What happens next? So it's about taking credit for moving the dial, about giving more functionality, and about really users loving the services that you're providing them and being able to get continual updates to that. And that's kind of the way we would say we'd pride ourselves in terms of being able to deliver Office 365 services and IT taking credit for those changes.
Absolutely.
So all of this, we've got more information. If you go to Fast Track, we've got an AKA link here, get Fast Track.
So the ability to provision up an Office 365 tenant, we want to show you our Fast Track tenant, which is our onboarding tenant. It's loaded full of content for training both your IT team as well as your end users, as well as a project plan of how you would plan out a deployment approach. So aka.ms/getfasttrack. We have a promo code of IMMEC that you can type in to generate this trial. It's a 90-day trial, up to 250 users, and then you can take it all the way to production if you like as well.
So what I was showing to get 250 users in that, that headroom, I guess, in my tenant, because normally a trial tenant has 25 users, it's vanilla, it doesn't have any of the services provisioned. If you go into Fast Track, it basically has full SharePoint sites provisioned. When you sign up, it will let you sign up with the initial mailboxes, those types of things. And it's fully populated. It's got videos hosted, how-to videos, all of Alistair's Ignite content, all the things that we've been building over the last couple of years, already hosted there. So if you're the IT guy who wants to learn how to use PowerShell, how to configure Exchange Online, how to configure SharePoint Online, all that training content is already built in to those sites. So it's pretty cool stuff in terms of once that's up and running.
Absolutely.
And even beyond that, we have also our Fast Track labs.
Exactly. So these labs are a little bit different from how we used to do labs in the past. For the last 10 years, we've been giving you DVD sets of labs and CD sets of virtual machines for you to expand out and run up on your own hardware. This release, to do that, to kind of simulate all the different components in Office 365 or Exchange on-premises, our DVD set's about 9 DVDs now, and it takes about a week to decompress, and then you've got to find a server that has a spare 64 gig of RAM to run it up. So instead, now we're provisioning these via Windows Azure. So if you do have a Windows Azure account or an MSDN subscription, you can bring your own Azure environment. You can go to this link here. We just released this today, this morning. And so it's not for wide distribution yet, but it's available for everyone at this conference. portal.fasttrack.office.com/labs/promo, NEC labs. And that will provision up these 5 lab sets here into your Azure environment as well. Again, bear in mind that Azure is kind of a per minute cost model. So if you have an MSDN account or one of the old TechNet accounts, you do have $150 a month to spend. When we've run these labs up, to do the whole lab, it takes about an hour, which costs about 50 cents. Just remember to shut down the VMs once you're finished. Otherwise, you'll burn through all of your Azure quota every month as well.
Yes, close the session. All right, so in terms of our IT Pro Network, this is something that on Yammer we've got all of the IT pros, especially from SharePoint Conference. We had a conference there 2 weeks ago in Las Vegas. We've got about 6,000 people. It is the biggest, I think it's the biggest Yammer network now, even bigger than the Yammer customer network.
It is, yeah.
Which is pretty cool. And these are all IT pros asking questions about Office 365. We want more Exchange admins on Yammer, whatever you think of Yammer, whether you like it or not. This is one of the cool places where you can ask questions, get responses from people who are actually MVPs, super knowledgeable in the space, that are hanging out in the Yammer community. Yeah. And a lot of these guys spanning all workloads. So they're going to be client guys, Exchange guys, SharePoint guys, Yammer guys, all in that same community. And we've also got groups within that in terms of where your best area is.
And this is generally where the product team hangs out as well. You know, it's a place that's great for advice, for discussing different topics, for kind of the high-level use case. But the one thing that we don't do on this network is kind of break-fix support. So if you do have break-fix issues, you should still go through the regular support channels. But if you want to chat about features in Exchange, understand a little bit more about something, yammer.com/ITProNetwork is the place to go.
Yes, and sometimes we do get a little bit deeper. Like if you want to Office deployment tool property ID or any of these things that I'm doing, like we'll actually have me or some of the guys from MCS or some of the really knowledgeable people answer those types of questions. PowerShell commands, something that, hey, how do I do X in PowerShell? That type of stuff we can surface up. So it's kind of the content that you'd otherwise find in TechNet or in some of the deeper content resources. You'll find a lot of guys that just do this every day, for a living, that are either partners or in IT departments or MVPs or Microsoft full-time employees, giving answers to all the questions that you'd have there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with that, we are 2 minutes away from time. So thank you all for being here this morning. Hopefully this sheds some light in terms of what the future beholds from a cloud services perspective. Again, the main message is it doesn't mean that jobs, roles go away. They do change. They've always changed. And that IT can take credit for any of the changes that you do deliver to end users. Yeah. And all those changes are auditable, reportable, and you've got full control, full transparency as to what's going on in the service.
Exactly. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Have a good week.
We'll take questions up the front. Oh, you want to go back a slide?
Sure.